Hello and welcome to a new edition of RAE, Radio Difusión Argentina al Exterior. This is the international service of the Argentine Radio, transmitting from the city of Buenos Aires, capital of the country, via the shortwaves of WRMI, frequency 5850 kHz, and also via internet on RAE.com.ar and RAE's app, available for mobile devices. My name is Fernando Farias, and together with sound technician Sergio Rios, we'll be bringing you this show in English for Friday, June 14, 2024, with news, with sports, with music. And today we've got an anniversary that we want to remember. It is the death anniversary of Jorge Luis Borges, arguably the most important Argentine writer of all times. If there's one... writer that was close, an Argentine writer that was close to winning the Nobel Literature Prize, that was Jorge Luis Borges. He didn't, but nonetheless, he remains very important in the Spanish-speaking world and beyond. He was bilingual in English, and actually he had partly English background. In 1977, Borges gave an interview fully in English to PBS, to the show Firing Line, that was hosted by William Buckley. An hour-long interview that we had to edit down to 45 minutes of Borges talking to Buckley about various things, about current affairs back in 1977, obviously literature, art, Latin America, Argentina, a little bit of everything. It's a very interesting, enlightening talk that we wanted to share with you on the airwaves of RAE on the day that we remember Borges on his death anniversary. You know, he died on June 14, 1986. If you want to get in touch with us, you can send an email to qslrai@gmail.com or a letter to Maipú Street 555, and then of course Buenos Aires, Argentina. Let's get started now with the news. These are the headlines. President Milei arrives in Italy to join the G7 summit. Inflation continues to fall. According to official figures, it was 4.2% in May. Mexico, the opposition's Xochitl Gálvez challenges the June 1st elections. Russian Navy ships arrived in Cuba for a protocol visit. Heavy rains and cold weather hit central Chile and move into Argentina. Sports. Argentina's national football team faces Guatemala today in the last friendly before the Copa America. And these are the news. The Argentine President Javier Milei arrived in Bari, Italy, to join the G7 summit. He was invited by the host, Italian Premier Giorgia Meloni, with whom he will hold a bilateral meeting. The Argentine leader has also an encounter scheduled with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron. Within the framework of the summit, the President will also meet with the head of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva. This meeting will take place a few hours after the IMF approved the new disbursement of $800 million for Argentina. In announcing its decision, the fund once again praised the economic program of the Milei administration. After the conclave in Italy, the Argentine head of state will travel to Switzerland, and there he will attend the Summit for Peace in Ukraine, which was organized by the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Meanwhile, in Buenos Aires, the lower house is preparing to deal again in a few days with Milei's mega reforms bill, the so-called Bases Law. The initiative was approved in the Senate on Wednesday by one vote of difference, but with modifications granted to gain more support from certain lawmakers. These changes will now be analyzed by the lower house in approximately 2 weeks, according to parliamentary sources. The basic or basis law contemplates reforms in tax, administrative, labor and energy matters, among others. Its goal, according to Casa Rosada, is to open up the economy, reduce the size of the state, generate private employment and attract foreign investments. Inflation continues to fall in Argentina. It was 4.2% in May, according to the official statistics agency INDEC. In spite of the drop, the cumulative figure so far this year exceeds 70%. Minister of Economy Luis Caputo highlighted the inflation figure in his social networks. According to him, it is the first interannual deceleration since July 2023. However, according to some media and analysts, the downward trend could be affected in the next 2 months. The reason for this is the increase in utilities fares due to subsidies cuts at the time of the highest consumption amid the lower winter temperatures. In Mexico, the opposition's former candidate Xochitl Gálvez filed a challenge to last June's elections. Before the National Electoral Institute, she also requested sanctions against outgoing President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. In addition, the conservative leader requested an investigation into whether organized crime was involved in the pro-government campaign. In any case, Gálvez clarified in a communique, "It is not about requesting the annulment of the election, but to sanction the president for interference." In the elections of June 1st, pro-government hopeful Claudia Sheinbaum won with almost 60% of the votes, more than 30 points ahead of her rival. Heavy rains hit the central area of Chile, causing power outages, traffic problems and school suspensions. The most affected regions were Coquimbo, Valparaíso, O'Higgins, and the metropolitan area of capital Santiago. In any case, the worst is over, according to the Undersecretary of the Interior, Manuel Monsalve. Chilean weather authorities warn that the precipitation front is now advancing towards Argentina. The phenomenon will also cause a drop in temperature. Russian Navy vessels arrived in Cuba for a protocol visit. A frigate, an oil tanker, a tugboat and a nuclear submarine make up the flotilla sent by Moscow to the Caribbean country. It was received in the port of Havana by Captain José Luis Soto of the Cuban Navy. Official sources reiterated that none of the Russian ships carry any nuclear weapons, so there is no risk whatsoever for the region. Now, sports. The Argentine national football team will face Guatemala in the last friendly match before the Copa America. The game will be played this Friday at the FedEx Stadium in Washington. The Albiceleste coach, Lionel Scaloni, confirmed yesterday at a press conference that Lionel Messi will be part of the starting 11. The world champions are coming off a 1-0 win over Ecuador last Sunday in Chicago. The debut in the Copa America will be on June 20 against Canada in Atlanta. At the same time, the local championship enters a pause for several weeks while the continental tournament is played in the US. On the fifth date, Racing Club lost yesterday its undefeated record and lost 2-0 to Lanús as a visitor. Deportivo Riestra, meanwhile, achieved a feat by beating River Plate 2-0 for the first time. The same result was obtained by Instituto in its win over Newell's Old Boys of Rosario and Sarmiento de Junín over Estudiantes de La Plata. The other match played yesterday was Tigre versus Belgrano, which ended in a 1-1 tie. And these were the news on RAE, Radio Difusión Argentina al Exterior.
RAE, Argentina al Mundo. 平面向世界
Rai Argentine vers le monde
Rai Argentina to the world
Rai 世界に向けてアルゼンチン
Rai Argentina al mundo
Rai Argentina al mundo
Rai Argentinian in the world
Rai Argentina al mundo
Coming up, an interview that Jorge Luis Borges, the Argentine writer, gave to American TV network PBS back in 1977. We are playing this on the occasion of the death anniversary of Borges that is marked today. He passed away exactly 38 years ago. But June 14 is also a date in which other things happen, such as Juan Carlos Baglietto was born on a day like this, 68 years ago. Juan Carlos Baglietto, a very important singer who emerged to prominence in the early 1980s as part of a musical, artistic movement in the city of Rosario, and he left a number of hits, such as this one called The Iceberg.
A veces cuando pienso que todo está perdido Voy hacia alguna de las formas de la muerte Me pego un tiro con una palabra Que alguna vez me fue tan transparente
En la ternura del agua que corre Me recuerdo en la llegada de unos trenes
Sales de los mares, curvas de los puertos Con mujeres descalzas en el verde Voy hacia el fuego como la mariposa Y no hay rima que rime con vivir No te pares, no te mates Solo es una forma más de demorarse Las tardes tranquilas cuando extraño todo Pienso que todo no es lo que perdí Una rosa de fe y a una costa de perder Se pierde pero se gana La lucha es de igual a igual contra uno mismo Y eso es ganarla No te pares, no te mates Solo es una forma más de demorarte
Recuerdo la quietud de la tierra, la quietud estaba dentro.
Se cree más en los milagros a la hora del entierro.
Este hombre trabajó.
¿Quién escribirá su historia?
La amigos que siguen igual
la gloria en zapatillas el florero vacío quién sabe si se puso a pensar para que vivo vivo para no perder voy hacia el fuego como la mariposa y no hay rima que rime con vivir no se paren no se maten solo es una forma más de demorarse, no se paren, no se maten, solo es una forma más de demorarse, solo es una forma más de demorarse, solo es una forma más de demorarse.
About himself, he said recently, as for a message, well, I have no message.
Right, something's no message whatever.
Some things simply occur to me, and I write them down with no aim to hurt anyone or to convert anyone. This is all I can say. I make this public confession of my poverty before everybody. Besides, yes. Had I not done so,
but I think you would have known. No?
You would have known it was true. Yes, that's what I said.
Yes.
I'm just going to finish this introduction, and then we'll
that's
exchange.
That's right. Yes. Right.
About him, others have written that he is the greatest living writer. Still others that he has influenced the literature of the world more than anyone alive. Jorge Luis Borges lives here in Buenos Aires, although he has traveled extensively, especially in the United States, and taught most recently at Harvard for a year. He is blind since the late 50s. He does not mind it, he says, because now he can live his dreams with less distraction. He took early to his craft, translating into Spanish from the English Oscar Wilde's The Happy Prince when he was 6 years old. The translation, thought to have been the work of his father, was used as a school text. He began to publish in the 20s poems, essays, short works of fiction. In the late 30s, he got his first job as a menial assistant in a library, but even this he lost for the offense of having signed a declaration in opposition to General Perón in 1946. When Perón was ousted, Mr. Borges was made director of the National Library, and his literary work continuing at an extraordinary rate, and including now translations into Spanish of major American writers. He took to lecturing widely, acquainting many Americans with his writings and with himself. Concerning his work, his critics disagree, except on the proposition that it will survive the century. Mr. Borges is substantially but not entirely apolitical. Since Argentina is having its problems, I thought to begin by asking, is there anything, Mr. Borges, distinctively Argentinian about those problems?
Well, I wonder. I know very little about politics, but I think we have the right government now. Government of gentlemen, not of hoodlums. I don't think we're ripe for the democracy as yet, maybe in 100 years or so. But now I think we have the right government. I think that the government means well, and the government is acting, and, as I said, we are governed by gentlemen and not by the scum of the earth, as happened, well, quite a short time ago.
When you say that it might be 100 years before...
Well, or let's say 500, no. Well,
after our time.
Yes.
Why is that? Is it something distinctive to Argentinians, distinctive to the hemisphere, distinctive to what?
I can't tell you, since I know my own country and I'm very puzzled by my country. I wish I understood my country. I can only love it. I can do what I can for it, but I don't pretend to understand it. I'm no historian.
Well, when you say that you don't understand it, do you mean that you are continually surprised by what happens?
Yes, I am continually surprised, but I try to live in my own private, secluded, in my own private, the literary world.
Well, do you recognize an obligation of the man of letters to involve himself in politics to the extent of saying no to the barbarians?
Yes, to that extent I do, not more than that. I think that if I do my literary work honestly, then, in a sense, I am doing something for my country. And as I can do nothing else, being old, blind, and lonely, I to try to do my to work as best as I can. That's all I can do. I have never involved myself in politics. I have never allowed myself to be bribed. I haven't even tried to be famous, though I have become quite famous. But I have done nothing whatever to it in that sense. I have merely kept on writing, never thinking of the public or the readers. I write to please myself. I mean, if I were Robinson Crusoe in my desert island, I would go on writing. Yeah. And I suppose I would write more or less the same kind of stuff I'm turning out now.
Well, you were criticized, to be sure, in a left journal in America for instance, advocating the execution of Regis Debray in Bolivia. Is that correct?
Yes, I suppose it's correct. But after all, I think that capital punishment is kinder than it's a prison. I'm not against capital punishment. I wouldn't mind being executed, but I wouldn't like spending 5 years in jail. Personally, I wouldn't mind being executed. In fact, I think I would welcome it, since I'm rather tired of life, since life has few pleasures left to me.
Well, if you insist on being executed, let me know and I'll suggest a provocation.
You think of the jail more. No. Well, why not? Maybe you're right. Well, he wasn't being sentimental about himself or feeling sorry for himself. Or abounding, as Kipling had it, in loud self-pity. I don't think a man should abound in loud self-pity. At least I have tried my best to not to do so.
Well, do you find this this challenge, this inclination to self-pity, a characteristic of the age?
I wonder if a characteristic of the age. I know very little about the age. But maybe it is rather common here in this country. The people go in for being sorry for themselves, which is a pity, I think. But of course, if you go in for being sorry for yourself, then you keep on being sadder and sadder, no?
You mean because there's so much to be sorry for?
Oh, yes. But sometimes, walking down the street, I sometimes feel unaccountably happy, and then I welcome that happiness. Because I don't know where that happiness comes from, but still it should be welcomed. I think happiness should always be welcomed.
Is it a happiness that comes as a result of the satisfaction you take in your work?
No, personally, I dislike my work. I prefer the work of any other writer. I think that every time I have not been given the Nobel Prize, I think that the Swedish Academy has acted justly. I don't deserve that prize. When I think that...
Well, you certainly don't deserve to be put in the same class with Quasimodo.
But I don't deserve to be put in the same class as Kipling or Faulkner or Bernard Shaw.
Well, they can't miss all the time.
No.
Well, do you mean you have officially abandoned any intention of receiving the Nobel Prize?
No. I think it's a kind of game that is played every year. No, every year I am given the Nobel Prize, and then it turns out it's next year. It's a kind of habit I have, or a kind of habit that the Scandinavians have. In fact, you might recall an old Norse tradition, no, not to give me the Nobel Prize. No. That's a part of Norse mythology, and very fond of Norse. Well, all things Scandinavian. I love all things Scandinavian.
Is it your point that you would lose respect in the Nobel Committee if they awarded you the prize?
I would think it was a very generous mistake, but I would accept it greedily.
What are you at work on now, Mr. Borges?
Well, precisely, I'm working on a book with a friend of mine, Maria Kodama, on Snorri Sturlason, the Icelandic historian. And then I'm also writing a book of poems to be published by MSA in Buenos Aires. And then a book of short stories to be published by MSA in Buenos Aires. And I'm writing off and on all the time, since I have nothing else to do. I live by myself.
Well, now you say that you dislike your work. Do you also dislike working?
No, I enjoy working, but I don't like the work. You know what Carlyle said? Carlyle said that all work is contemptible, but that doing that work is not contemptible. It may be the only justification for a man. And I think he was right, because after all, when I'm working and fulfilling my destiny, what else can I do but work? What else can a blind man do but work? But as the result of the work, I leave that to others. I never read what I have written, except when I have to go to proof sheets. But I enjoy working. And not only working, but I enjoy planning my work. Perhaps more than the actual writing of it or dictating of it, since writing, of course, is has been forbidden to me, no.
You have been compared to both Milton and Homer.
Well, yes, in the sense of being blind, yes.
Yes, yes. But in other senses too, you've been compared to them. I know that you make it a practice not to read anything about yourself.
No, I only read one book, a book published by a Bolivian, his name was Tamayo, and an Argentine writer, Ruiz Diaz. That's the only book I've read about. And they tell me there are some 300 books written about me. But I think the writer should choose a better subject.
Well, in that case, I'm in a position to instruct you about yourself.
Ah, well, I suppose you are.
You've been compared to both Milton and Homer in terms of a highly illuminated internal vision. Is this a correct judgment as far as you're concerned?
Well, I do my best to think it a correct judgment. At least I try to put up with blindness. Of course, when you're blind, time flows in a different way. It flows, let's say, down an easy slope. I have sometimes spent sleepless nights, night before last, for example, but I didn't feel especially unhappy about it, because time was, well, sliding down that, was it flowing down that easy slope.
You mean you'd have felt less, more unhappy if you had been able to see?
Oh yes, of course I would.
Why?
Well, I can't very well explain it. These are a sort of years. When I first went blind, I mean for reading purposes, I felt very unhappy. But now I feel that being blind is, let's say, is part of my world. I suppose that happens to everybody. When one's in jail, one thinks of being in jail as being a part of one's world. Or when one's sick also, after all.
Well, how do you refresh yourself as someone who is blind?
Well, I'm rereading all the time, having books reread to
I
me.
See.
I do very little contemporary reading. But I'm always going back to certain writers. And among those writers, I would like to mention an American writer. I would like to mention Emerson. I think of Emerson, it's not only as a great prose writer, everybody knows that, but a very fine intellectual poet. But that's the only intellectual poet who had any ideas, no? Emerson was brimming over with ideas.
Well, you did a great deal to reintroduce Americans to many American writers, including Emerson, isn't that correct?
Yes, I have done my best.
Now, what is it that
Emerson and also, well, another writer I greatly love.
Hawthorne.
Well, but in Hawthorne, what I dislike about Hawthorne is all writing fables. Well, in the case of Poe, well, you get tales, but there was no moral tagged on to them, no. Well, in the case of Hawthorne, things are always becoming lessons or parables. But I would think of Melville, one of the great writers of the world, no?
How do you account for the failure of Melville to achieve any recognition during his lifetime, any significant recognition?
Because people thought of him as writing travel books. I have the 1911 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. There's an article about Melville, and they speak of him much in the same way as they might speak about Captain Marryat, for example, or other writers. I think that he wrote many travel books. People thought of him writing in that way, so they couldn't see all that Moby Dick or the White Whale meant.
What part did you play in the rediscovery of Melville?
Well, in this country, I've done what I could, I suppose.
Had it already been translated when you were a student?
No, when I was a student, no, it hadn't been translated. It had been translated afterwards. And I translated a very fine story of Melville's. You know it, of course, the Bartleby.
Yes. You translated that for the first time?
Yes, for the first time. Then I also think we did the first translation of Hawthorne's The Wakefield, mm-hmm. A very fine story. After the manner of Kafka, or rather Kafka came after him, no? But Kafka enabled us to read Hawthorne better, which is what a great writer does. In a sense, he creates the forerunners. He makes people read them in a different way. So maybe I shouldn't have read Hawthorne's Wakefield as well as I did, or as I should have done, had I not read Kafka before. I think that's one of the functions, one of the gifts of a great writer, is to make people read in a different way, go over the old text in a different fashion. So the past has been continually modified, no?
Yes. Well, now you say that you spend most of your time reading the older writers now. Is it because you reject the newer writers, or because you choose to continue to be unfamiliar with them?
Because I'm afraid that I'll find the new writers more or less like myself. I'm afraid of
you won't.
Well, I suppose I will. I suppose all contemporaries are more or less alike, no? The scientists like what I write. I prefer going back to the 19th, to the 18th century, and then, of course, also going back to the Romans, since I have no Greek, but I had Latin. Of course, my Latin is very rusty, but still, as I once wrote, the fact of having forgotten Latin is in itself a gift.
Yes.
To have known Latin and forgotten it is something that sticks to you somehow.
And has to
you. But I have done most of my reading in English. I read very little in Spanish. Because I was educated practically in my father's library, and that was compounded of English books. So when I think of the Bible, I think of the King James Bible. When I think of the Arabian Nights, I think of Lane translation or of Captain Burton's translation. When I think, of course, of Persian literature, I think in terms of Brown's Literary History of Persia and, of course, of Fitzgerald's. And, in fact, I remember the first book I read on History of South America was Prescott's Conquest of Peru.
Is that right?
Yes, and then I fell back on Spanish writers. But I have done most of my reading in English. I find English far finer language than Spanish.
Why?
Well, there are many reasons. Firstly, English is both a Germanic and a Latin language. It goes two registers. For example, for any idea you take, you have two words. Those words do not mean exactly the same. For example, if I say regal, they're not exactly the same thing as saying kingly. Or if I say fraternal, it's not the same as saying brotherly. Or dark and obscure. Those words are different. It will make all the difference, speaking, for example, of the Holy Spirit. It will make all the difference in the world in a poem if I wrote about the Holy Spirit and not about the Holy Ghost. Since ghost is a fine, dark Saxon word, while spirit is a light, it's a Latin word. Well, and then there is another reason. The reason is that I think that of all languages, English is the most physical of all languages.
The most what?
Physical.
Mm-hmm.
For example, he loomed over. You can't very well say that in Spanish.
Asomó?
Well, no, but not exactly the same. And then in English, you can do almost anything with verbs and prepositions. For example, to laugh off, to dream away. Those things can't be said in Spanish. To live down something, to live up to something. You can't say those things in Spanish. They can't be said, or in the Romance language. I suppose it can be said in German. But my German isn't too good. I taught myself German for the sake of reading Schopenhauer in the text. That was way back in 1916. I had read Schopenhauer in English. I was greatly attracted to Schopenhauer, and then I thought, I'll try and read him in the text. And then I taught myself German, and then at long last I read Die Welt als Wille und Vorstellung in the text, and the Parergung Paralipomen also.
Well, do you write your poetry in English or
no,
in Spanish?
No, I respect English too much. I write it in Spanish.
Well, do you pass on the translations? Do you personally pass on the translations, or do you simply entrust like Kerrigan?
No, I have people like Alistair Reid, Di Giovanni and Kerrigan, who greatly bettered my texts. Mm-hmm. Greatly bettered than them in a translation. And then, of course, in Spanish, words are far too cumbersome, they're far too long. Well, I'll go back to one of my hobbies. For example, if you take an English adverb, or two English adverbs, you say for example, quickly, slowly, and then the stress falls on the significant part of the word, quickly, slowly. Well, if you say it in Spanish, you say lentamente, rapidamente, and then the stress falls, let's say, on the non-significant part, on the gadget,
right,
as I call it,
right,
no?
Right.
And all that makes for a very cumbersome language.
Yes.
But still, Spanish is my destiny, it's my fate, and I have to do what I can with Spanish.
Well, does the fact that the Spanish language is less resourceful than the English language necessarily make it less complete as poetry?
No, I think that when poetry is achieved, it can be achieved in any language. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that a fine Spanish verse could hardly be translated into another language, or is, returned to something else. But when beauty happens, well, there it is, no?
Yes.
You know what Whistler said? People were discussing art in Paris. people spoke about, well, the influence of heredity, tradition, environment, and so on. And then Whistler said in his lazy way, art happens.
Art happens.
Yes. Art happens, and that's true. And I should say that beauty happens. And besides, I think that beauty is not, it's not something real. I think beauty is happening all the time. Art is happening all the time. In a chance conversation, a man may say a very fine thing, not being aware of it. I'm hearing fine sentences all the time, from the man in the street, for example, from anybody.
So you consider yourself a transcriber, to a certain extent?
Yes, in a sense, I do. And I think that I have written some fine lines, because everybody has written some fine lines. That's not my privilege. You writers are bound to write something fine, at least now and then, or off and on.
Even Longfellow?
Longfellow has some very beautiful lines. I'm very old-fashioned, but I like, this is a forest primeval, the murmuring pines and the hemlock. That's a very fine line.
Yes, yes, yes.
I don't know how people look down on Longfellow. Maybe he was too much of a literary man, no? He was much the same kind of poet as Ezra Pound, no? I mean, he took most things from his books, and not from his own experience. But his translation of the Divine Comedy is a very fine translation. In fact, I read it in English, I read it in Italian.
You did? Whose translation?
Longfellow's translation.
Oh, I see.
Yes. And I began, because I've always been a bit of a prig, by reading firstly the notes and then the text. The first thing I read were the notes as a boy. And then I went on to the text. And then I took up the text. That must have been, some 30 years ago. And then I found out that I had no necessity of knowing Italian, that if I had Spanish, I had Italian, and that Italian could be, and that the Divine Comedy could be read by anybody who had Spanish. That's all the languages are much the same. The Italian editions of the Commedia are very fine. The Momigliano, for example, or Greba, or the Grabher. There's a note to almost every line. So if you don't understand the verse itself, you can also fall back on the notes. That's very interesting. I think I have read the Divine Comedy some 11 or 12 times over, and I have no Italian. I couldn't talk in Italian or to see an Italian film or hear an Italian film. I couldn't understand it. And I have no Italian blood. But somehow Italian and Spanish, well, they're so alike.
Well, would you understand it if it were read to you?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Because if it were read to me, it might be read too quickly.
Yes, yes.
Well, if I don't understand a line in Italian, then of course I can reread it.
Yes. These thoughts that go through your mind that you transcribe, as you put it, into prose and poetry.
I wonder if there's any essential difference. I don't think so. I think the gist is the same, no? I mean, when an idea comes to me, I don't know whether it will become a tale, will become a short story, or a sonnet, or maybe an example of free verse. That comes afterwards. Firstly, I see the whole thing from afar. And then somehow it has to be licked into shape.
Now, this was as much true when you could see as since?
Always, yes.
The technique was always the same? The
technique is always the same. The technique is the technique of being, let's say, an onlooker, of seeing things, but seeing them at first in a very misty way. And then afterwards, while getting nearer them, seeing them closer. But in the case of a story, in the case of a story, or even in the case of a poem, I always know the beginning and the end. Generally, I know the first line and the last line, or at least what will happen. But then I have to find out what happens in between, no? And then, of course, I have to grope, and maybe and lose my way, and maybe go back.
Oh, you do have to struggle in between, do you?
Of course I do, but that's, the struggle that's is part
that's
of the game.
That's not merely an act of transcription.
No, it isn't. But the struggle makes for enjoyment.
But do you know at the outset that you're going to succeed if you know the first and last lines?
Yes, I know. But I wonder if I have succeeded. People say I have now and then.
I think there's a lot of agreement on that point.
Well, but I don't believe in democracy, why should I believe in a lot of agreement? No, it's all those mere statistics.
But is it Is there a critical democracy in which you do believe, or do you find that the opinion of the critics is often mistaken so that very little expertise lies in the field?
Having been a critic, I know that their opinions are generally mistaken. In fact, I have been mistaken many times over.
Can you give an example of someone whose reputation was for years mistaken? Is Melville a good example?
Melville might be. Mm-hmm. But Melville now, I think, holds his own, no?
Yes.
And he should.
Yes.
They're not in all his books.
Is there a living writer who is vastly underappreciated?
I know very little about living writers. In my case, I could say that I'm overrated. Greatly overrated. My stuff is greatly overrated.
Well, what about Neruda?
Neruda, when he was a sentimental poet, he was quite bad. When he was a communist, he wrote very fine poetry. That means that communist was the kind of food he needed, no? Even as Walt Whitman needed the democracy, no? But I think Neruda is a fine poet. In fact, I was in Stockholm when they were going to, once upon a time, was there, and then I said that if this was more or less on the eve of the judgment, no?
Yes.
And I said, well, if they choose me, they're making a mistake. Of course, I'll grab the prize if I can. But I think there are two candidates. Those two candidates would be Pablo Neruda and Jorge Eugene, at least in the Spanish language.
What about Gabriel Márquez?
Gabriel Márquez, I think he wrote the one book. The book, I think the book, it falls off, no? I think it begins well, but then at the end, the writer is as tired as the reader, perhaps, no?
Mm-hmm. What about Cortázar?
I know very little about him. Mm-hmm. I was editing a literary magazine, then a young man came up to see me. He wrote a manuscript. Then he came back within 10 days. Then I told him the story was going to be published, but he was going to illustrate it. That story was La Casa Tomada by Julio Cortázar. Mm-hmm. Then I met him in Paris and he reminded me of the incident. But I haven't read his other books. That story is a very fine story. After the manner of perhaps Arthur Machen. Yes, I should say so.
Are there any of these writers, Mr. Borges, whose work simply resists Spanish translation into Spanish? Nabokov, for instance.
I wonder if he has been translated.
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Well, then he does resist, I guess.
Well, in the case of Joyce, of course, well, he can't be translated. I don't think James Joyce could be translated, unless he invented. No, but of course, in the case of James Joyce, I mean, his craft is out of the language. And then that kind of thing can't be translated. When he writes, for example, the rivering waters of, the hither and thithering waters of night. How can you translate that? How can you translate rivering waters of?
It's like translating Lewis Carroll.
Well, it can't be done.
No.
It hasn't been done in German, because German is more or less akin to English, but not in Spanish. In Spanish, the whole thing is rather lame. You know?
Mm-hmm. Is Shakespeare successfully translated into Spanish?
No. Because Shakespeare also, I mean, he abounds in verbal music, in word craft. That kind of thing can't be translated. I attempted a translation of Macbeth. And then after a scene or two, I felt I couldn't do it. And I left it. But Macbeth would be my favorite. The Shakespearean tragedy. I mean, it's so tense. It begins at full speed and then goes on until the end, no?
Yeah, right. Are you one of the last admirers of Kipling?
I hope I'm not one of the last. I think Kipling was a very great man.
I know you do. But he's not very widely appreciated, or even read, is he?
No, because he's judged by his political opinions. And suppose opinions are on the surface. I don't think a writer should be judged by his opinions. I think when you write, you should be judged, well, by what you write, and you don't write with your opinions. Opinions, after all, are on the surface. They come and go. People hold many different opinions during their lifetime. But in the case of Kipling, he was a very wise man also, and his word craft is wonderful. When I remember, for example, Harp Song of the Dane Women, you see how stark the title of the poem is. How it doesn't even sound like English, it might be Old English or Old Norse. Harp Song of the Dane Women, and then Sicken Again for the Shouts and the Slaughter. There you get the Old English staff rhyme or alliteration. Sicken Again for the Shouts and the Slaughters.
Yes, yes.
Look, he's a very fine writer.
Was he appreciated in your childhood in Spanish or not?
Yes, he was.
He was.
But people think of him, I think, if a writer writes for children, he makes a mistake. I mean, as concerns his own fame. Because people think of him as only writing for children. In the case of Stevenson, for example. Why do people look down on Stevenson? Because they think only of Treasure Island. A very fine book, but the book meant for boys. But had they really saw the book, you feel that he's a very fine writer also. So perhaps it may be a mistake for a writer to attempt, let's say, the boyish fiction, or to attempt the detective fiction, because people think of him in terms of that particular kind of craft. I suppose in the case of Chesterton, people who know he's a very fine writer, but if people think of the Father Brown stories, then they're apt to class him with Ellery Queen or with even Philpotts or with any other writer.
Agatha Christie, yes, of course.
Is it a mistake?
Is it a mistake?
It may be a mistake for the fame of a writer, not for the writer himself.
Sure.
Because after all, I would, if the Father Brown stories didn't exist, I would feel it was a great loss. Mm-hmm. This, to me.
I agree.
At the same time, it has done him no good. It has done no good to his reputation.
Well, would you go so far as to say that a writer who seeks fame ought not to read books that children can enjoyably read?
No.
What about Tolkien, for instance?
Tolkien, I only found him utter boredom. I have never got inside his books.
Who got inside his books?
I have never got inside his books. Mm-hmm. I have always been an outsider, no?
Yes.
I attempted the Brotherhood. This is the Brotherhood of the Rings.
Yes, the Lordship of the Ring, isn't it?
The Lordship of the Ring, I don't know, but in any case, no rings were awarded me, no. I tried to enjoy him, I did my best. I was in Scotland at the time. There were two young Americans there who read him and laughed very loudly, but at the same time I felt that I got nothing out of the reading. When he was, when they went to Lewis Carroll, I thought that was sheer blasphemy, no. I'm so fond of Lewis Carroll. No, what I said was that a writer should not read, but not write. For children, because that may harm his reputation. Yeah. But after all, I wonder if reputations are worthwhile.
Well,
the work itself, the enjoyment of what you're doing. I only think of reading and of writing in terms of happiness. If you don't feel happy when you're reading or when you're writing, or if you don't feel greatly moved, then you're not really reading or writing. The whole thing is merely reading, for examination marks, and that of course, I won't say that way madness lies, but that way dullness lies.
Are you really saying that all writers should enjoy, are you saying that writers should enjoy writing?
Well, of course they should. At least I do. I mean, I have to toil, I have to work, but at the same time I'm enjoying it. See, after all, I have chosen that literary fate for myself.
Well, do you think a gymnast should enjoy?
I know nothing whatever about gymnasts. So it's whatever I say.
Well, ought they to enjoy their exercises? Would you say? Are you making a universal statement that
all people
should enjoy their work?
No, I suppose sweeping statements should be avoided, and that's a sweeping statement also. No, maybe one talks and falls into sweeping statements. No. In fact, if you talk, you are making a sweeping statement. If you say A is B, that's a sweeping statement. It may not be always B. There is something else. But I enjoy writing. In fact, one of the few enjoyments left.
So, as you put it, you would write even if you were Robinson Crusoe, and there was no
Well, Robinson Crusoe, the only thing I could do would be to write.
Yeah, you could build canoes.
Well, my canoes would be hardly worth the building. I don't think of any good of that kind of craft or any other.
You'd rather write a book about how to build a canoe than build a canoe, right?
Oh, yes, of course I would. Or maybe I would choose another subject, no.
Well, in your judgment, is the new Philistinism about which there is a lot of talk these days?
I don't know. There are so many Philistines involved.
Which is the one to which you have a special allergy?
I hate nationalism.
As distinguished from patriotism?
Yes, I think nationalism is a mistake. And I think that we're all more or less nationalistic. Maybe I am. When you say Argentinian, I was very angry. There was no such word. The word should be Argentine. Argentina is an invention, I mean, a word that rhymes to Bolivian or Peruvian. There's no such word, of course, since Argentine is an adjective.
Argentine is an adjective?
Of course, the Argentine Republic. Because Argentine is silver because of the Rio de la Plata. Mm-hmm. Silver River, yes. Argentina is no such word.
Are you talking in English, you mean?
No, I don't think there's any such word. In Spanish is no such word. You never say República Argentina, it's the República Argentina. Mm-hmm. Nobody, if you say Argentina, people would stare at you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How common is that error?
Yes, I was asked all the time when I was in the state, people asked me, are you an Argentinian? I said, no, there's no such thing. Are you Spaniard? Well, I left off being a Spaniard 150 years ago. Are you Latin American? Well, no. Who knows what a Latin American is? There's no such thing. I mean, a man is a Colombian, a Peruvian, a Bolivian, an Uruguayan, but hardly a Latin American. There's no such thing.
Or an Argentine.
Why not? I do my best to be a good Argentine.
And you say you detect this nationalism even in yourself. Do you detect a lot of it in current literature?
I detect it in myself.
You do?
I don't know why, for example, I write so much about such an invisible, such a dull city of Buenos Aires, and yet I love it. I write so much about myself, I'm not an interesting character, and yet I keep on being interested in Jorge Luis Borges, I don't know why.
Well, it's
a lifelong habit.
One of the books about you says that your most intense experiences are autobiographical, but that doesn't mean either that you're narcissistic or that you're nationalistic, does it?
I don't think so. I suppose it means more essential things. It means, it might mean thinking or loving or falling in love or being crossed in love or being now and then happy in love. Those things are essential to a man.
But they're universals, too.
They are universals, of course.
So therefore, you're not committing the sin of nationalism?
No, I'm not.
Or of narcissism?
No, I'm not.
I
don't think I'm a narcissist or a nationalist for that matter. But nationalism, I think, is wrong in all countries, especially in a new country like the mine. I mean, you can imagine, for example, let's say if you're a Chinaman or if you're a Japanese or even a European, or even if you're an American, you might be a nationalist. But here, where history is, let's say, some hundreds and odd years old, I mean, a country with no local color like this, we had quite a fine history in the last century, and now I think that we're more or less improving. I mean, we went through a very sad period, but now things are better, or at least we should hope they are better. Because our hope is part of the bettering, no?
Yes. Well, it didn't undermine your appreciation of Kipling, his nationalism.
No, because I think the British Empire made for good. I think you're right there.
So maybe it did no good to England. Objective, not just nationalism.
But in the case of Kipling, I not only think the British Empire made for good. But I think that Kipling needed that faith in order to write his books, even as all people needed democracy, or Neruda to communism, or Dante needed the Roman Catholic Church.
That it was a catalyst of his talent.
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. But why not? That's allowable. Not only allowable, it was we wished for.
Well, why don't we have any good literature coming out of the Soviet Union celebrating communism? Why isn't it a catalyst of anything beautiful?
Because people are bullied into it.
As distinct from Neruda, who was not?
No, he was not. Now, to the sincerity of Neruda, and nothing whatever. But still, it made him, I mean, he was a bad sentimental poetry. His love poetry was quite bad. He thought so too. And then that political faith came to him and saved him. I only met Neruda once in my life. He thought that nothing would be done with the Spanish language. And then I said to him, something might be done with English. And then he said, well, something has been done. And then I said, Spanish, nothing has been done as yet. And I said, no, I suppose not. And I said, well, we'll have to do something for the godforsaken language. And, well, we did. Well, at least he did.
How many books ago was that conversation?
That must have been way back in 1920-odd, eh?
He was already a communist, was he?
I don't know, because he never spoke about politics. But he loved the English language. I suppose he always did.
Well, you say that if you are bullied, then you stifle the muse?
I think you do, eh?
Well, but
you stifle everything.
Dante was bullied.
I don't think he was bullied. No, I don't think he was bullied. I think he believed in it.
But he lived in an age in which it was dangerous not to believe, didn't he?
Well, suppose he was intensely religious. For example, I can't think of myself being a Roman Catholic or even a Christian. Did I think I thoroughly enjoy the Divine Comedy without enjoying the framework, of course? Mm-hmm. I don't like the framework. The idea, I mean, of three institutions of hell, purgatory, and heaven, and paradise. I can't believe in that kind of thing. But still, if I accept that framework, then I have a wonderful poem, perhaps the greatest poem ever written. It's given me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But why is it that there is no intense love of communism that has brought out an equivalent masterwork? Of course, I suppose you can't have an equivalent masterwork, but a masterwork. Why? How do you account for the aridity of the entire Soviet experience in the last 50 years, 60 years?
What do you think aridity has to explain away? I think it's quite common. For example, I'm hurting you by saying this. If you take the United States, you have at least half a dozen men of genius. I mean,
from a literary point of view, 200 years?
Well, you have, for example, you have Poe, you have Melville, you have Whitman, you have Hawthorne, you have Henry James. Well,
that's
you have Frost.
What?
Well,
Pound.
Well, I don't want to rope him in, but if you do,
yeah.
It's not my funeral. Well, but at the same time, if you think of Canada and Australia, they have produced nothing, produced practically nothing. So maybe the American Revolution made for good from a literary point of view.
You consider six people in 200 years a profusion of genius and aridity the rule of thumb.
Yes, I should say so.
But surely,
well, what I mean to say is that, well, you may like or dislike Poe. I don't think much of him as a poet, but I think of him as being a man of genius.
Mm-hmm.
You may like or dislike Whitman. You can find quite bad lines in him.
Mm-hmm.
But he can't be thrown away. You can't think of contemporary literature and
dismiss Whitman.
Yes, and dismiss them. They can't be thrown away.
Right.
While other writers may be thrown away. For example, South America has produced nobody worthwhile, I mean, to the whole world. I mean, I suppose we have some fine writers. But they're fine writers, let's say, for Argentines, or for Chileans, or for Peruvians, and so on. But they mean nothing whatever to the world.
Well, you do. Neruda did.
Well, that's
Neruda did.
Well, in my case, I think that what you're saying is a form of pessimism, say that, or of optimism.
Thank you very much, Mr. Borges.
To thank you for extraordinary patience. No.
You can have my patience anytime you want.
Well, thank you, sir.
And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
Well, that was a talk, an interview, pretty interesting and deep interview, which is actually an hour long, and it's available on YouTube, but we had to edit it for the purpose of fitting it into our show. Jorge Luis Borges, what else can we say? Talking to William Buckley back in 1977 for this interview aired by PBS, and we played it on the 38th anniversary of Borges' death in 1986, June 14. We are signing off now. The sound technician for today was Sergio Rios. My name is Fernando Farias. This is RAE, the international service of the Argentine Radio. Thank you very much for listening. Hopefully, we'll meet again on the airwaves on Tuesday. Monday is a holiday, and there will be no show on that day. It's a holiday on the to honor Martín Miguel de Güemes, an Independence War hero. So, enjoy the weekend. Happy Father's Day also, which in Argentina is marked on Sunday, this Sunday. And join us next week for new shows of RAE in English. Ciao.